again.
All right, my friends, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives there for you in MP3 format. Sorry I was out last week. Had a bit of a bug and decided to spend all day last Saturday sleeping. But I'm back now and got a great show lined up for you today. George Motschke in the first hour and Loretta Napoleone will be back in the second hour to talk about her new book about Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Great book that I read last night. You can find me on the blog, usually at antiwar.com. And also, I want to give a quick plug to Derek's Martial Arts Gym on Alpine off of South Congress. The website is dmagdmag.com. And I should mention that antiwar.com is doing its quarterly fundraiser. And all those of you who rely on antiwar.com to get you the most important news from around the world every day like I do, it's time for us to go ahead and put our money where our mouth is and show some support. And I guess I should mention I'm always kind of running a little fundraiser of my own at weekendinterviewshow.com as well. All right, so let's go ahead and bring up our first guest. His name is George W. Motschke. He's the author of the book The Lie Behind the Lie Detector that he wrote with Gino J. Scalabrini. He's currently a translator for the U.S.-Iran Tribunal and is a former Army interrogator. He runs the website antipolygraph.org. Welcome to the show, George.
Thank you very much, Scott.
It's nice to have you on today. Tell me, first of all, what is the U.S.-Iran Tribunal?
It's an organization that was set up, the full name is the Iran-United States Claims Tribunal. It was set up after the hostage crisis to resolve property disputes between Iranian and American plaintiffs. And
you're referring to the hostage crisis of 1979.
Correct.
And you're a translator for the lawyers still working on settling that case out, huh?
Yes, there are some major cases still remaining.
I see. Okay. Well, fast enough for government work, I guess. Do they not have a speedy trial clause at the Hague Tribunal, or how does that work?
No. The pace of procedures depends really on the parties involved.
I see. All right. So, first of all, I guess, tell us a little bit of your own story, what your rank was in the Army, and how you became interested in going to try to work at the FBI and all that stuff.
Okay. Well, I enlisted in the Army in 1983, so I began as a private and eventually worked my way up to sergeant as an interrogator. Trained in the Arabic language. Then I got an ROTC scholarship and became commissioned as a second lieutenant. And again, continued in the military intelligence branch. In college, I also picked up the Persian language. So in any event, I was at the military intelligence school at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. And after that, I got contacted by the Army Reserve, asked to come to Washington, D.C. To support the FBI in counter-terrorist operations during the Gulf War. So rather than going to Iraq like I expected during that war, I spent it all in an office building in Washington, D.C., working with the FBI.
Okay, and then the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, you went to work for the FBI during that case, right?
Right, right. After the war, I was released from active duty and was brought back again in 1993 for the World Trade Center bombing case.
All right. Let's hold it right there, George, and we'll pick this up when we get back from this break. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with George Motschke from antipolygraph.org. We'll be right back. show. Oh, hey there, everybody. All right, I'm Scott. I'm talking with George Moschke. He's the author of The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, and he runs the website antipolygraph.org. And when we left off at the break, you were talking about how you were still in the Army, an interrogator, fluent in Arabic, Farsi, and French, and then you were attached to the FBI after the first World Trade Center bombing.
Right. I was in the Army Reserve at the time, to be clear. I was brought onto active duty and then farmed out to the FBI to provide linguistic support for that investigation. And what I did in New York was to translate evidence that had been seized in that case, in particular, a number of bomb manuals that were prepared at, these are like handwritten notes bound into a sort of textbook that were prepared at camps in Afghanistan or Pakistan and were entered as evidence in the case.
And at the time, you got letters of commendation from Louis Free and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, Director Free sent me a letter of appreciation for my work during that investigation.
Okay, now, so by the time you went to go apply to work for the FBI in Los Angeles, were you already out of the Army at that point?
Well, again, I was still in the Army Reserve.
Okay.
To be clear, I spent 4 years on active duty enlisted, but as an officer, I've been only a reserve officer, not active duty.
Okay. So then what happened when you went to go apply to work for the FBI?
Well, the big life-changing event was the pre-employment polygraph. I had sailed through other portions of the application process and had been fast-tracked for FBI hire. But during my polygraph examination, I was accused in so many words of being some kind of a spy, in that, you know, bear in mind, the FBI had just started polygraph screening in 1994 as a condition of hiring. I applied and went through my polygraph in 1995. So the questions asked were about topics like, have you ever disclosed classified information to anyone who was unauthorized to receive it? Have you had contacts with a foreign intelligence service? Have you ever sold illegal drugs? Have you used illegal drugs? Have you?
And you failed on all those questions.
I was accused of deception on all of those items, yes. And then I answered.
So were you actually a drug dealer for a foreign government then?
Never, never. I've never used an illegal drug, let alone sold them. And I've never had unauthorized contacts with the Foreign Intelligence Service, and I've never disclosed classified information to people who were not authorized to receive it.
All right, well, let me interrupt you real quick to just emphasize that this actually is very important. A lot of times, you know, most of us probably have never been lie detected and probably never will be, but this does affect our lives. It was only, last month when, based on a guy who passed the lie detector with flying colors, that they basically locked down the New York subway system and now are randomly searching everybody's bag, based on this guy who was later disproven, but who at the time had passed the lie detector, and that was good enough, right?
Well, yeah, the lie detector was certainly used to bolster this fellow's story. And it, the New York Police Department, I think, pretty clearly believed him more because he had passed a polygraph. It turns out, though, that the people this source had fingered were also polygraphed, and they passed when they denied having anything to do with such a plot. So,
but you still have to open your bag to get on the subway anyway.
Yeah, that's indeed going on. And there's actually an interesting article on antiwar.com criticizing that policy as being very unlikely to actually catch or deter a terrorist.
Okay,
so few people can be screened.
So how was it that if you were not actually a drug dealer or a spy for any foreign governments, how was it that you failed so miserably on this FBI test then, George?
Well, to understand that, you need to know a little bit about how polygraph testing works, and most people are ignorant of that, as I was at the time of my polygraph. The dirty little secret behind the polygraph is that you're secretly expected to answer some of the questions deceptively, even though you're told to answer everything truthfully.
Right. This is the control questions, right?
The so-called control questions.
Yeah. Now, my layman's understanding about this before reading through your website was basically they'll ask you, what's your name, what's your birthday, what color is the sky, and that those are the benchmarks to show you're telling the truth. But what you're saying basically is they're trying to force you to go ahead and tell a lie and then use that as the benchmark for the rest of the questions.
That's correct. The polygrapher will falsely tell the examinee that questions about his name, the day of the week, or whether the lights are on in the room provide some sort of baseline for truth, because it's obvious to both the examinee and the examiner that the answers to those questions will be truthful. But the fact of the matter is that those questions are not scored at all. The way they score the test is by comparing your reactions to the relevant questions, which in my case were about espionage and illegal drug use and sales, to questions on which they try to trick you into lying, or which they secretly expect that everyone will lie. For example, did you ever lie to a loved one? Did you ever lie to a person in a position of authority? Did you ever drive while under the influence of alcohol?
So basically, these are questions that they figure that the answer has got to be yes, but also that if you're being asked this on an application for whether you're going to be hired as an FBI agent, that you'll probably want to lie and say, no, I've never lied to anyone in a position of authority before, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
But then the problem is, if you haven't lied to someone in a position of authority, or if you haven't driven drunk, then your truthful answer is marked down as the baseline for what's deception from here on out.
Exactly. And if you feel, if you don't feel anxious when answering that question, and on the other hand, you feel more anxious when truthfully denying something that you would never think of doing, but that you know, if you're disbelieved, it'll cost you the job, like, are you a spy? Well, the risk of a false positive, of your wrongly failing the test when you're telling the truth, goes up.
Which really gets right to the heart of this is, a lie detector is actually not a lie detector. It's what? It detects your pulse and your sweat, and how does it work?
Yeah, it has three key components. It measures your heart rate and relative blood volume. That's the pressure cuff that goes on the arm. It measures your respiration. Those are tubes around the thorax and abdomen. And it measures either skin conductance or resistance, which is a function of perspiration. And those are the two attachments that go on the fingers of one hand.
So these things are correlated to telling lies, but not necessarily. You could, as you said, set the thing off just by the fear of being disbelieved, right?
Right. Well, to begin with, let's be clear. There's no reaction that's unique to deception. A polygrapher can't look at a chart and say, there's a lie. Sometimes when people lie or feel anxious, their breathing changes. They may perspire more, their heart may beat faster, their blood pressure may go up. But other things can cause these reactions too, like fear of not being believed, or embarrassment, or discomfort at being asked a very personal question.
In fact, I watched a short video called The Dynamics of Lying that I believe was produced for the Discovery Channel, where they asked this woman, what's your name, what's your address, what color is the sky kind of questions, the fake control questions. And then the polygrapher says to her, okay, now I'm going to ask you a very personal question that could be very embarrassing. And the whole needles, they're all going completely off the chart. He hasn't even asked her the question yet. Right. And she's already registering deception on the little graph.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that can be, in some cases, used as a control question. And they'll compare that to reactions to questions about a crime that's under investigation or in security screening, like the sort of are you a spy questions. Those are used for comparison purposes. And yes, they're not necessarily reactions are not necessarily caused by deception. Any number of factors can cause them.
We're sort of falling into a trap. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say is that these reactions can also be produced by anyone at will. So if you want to beat the test, the way to do it is to make sure you react more strongly to the control questions than to the relevant ones. And so this is another shortcoming of the polygraph is that, you don't have to be a psychopath or a trained spy to beat the exam. All you need to do is you need to understand the distinction between the control and relevant questions and covertly augment your reactions to the control questions.
On your website, I believe it was somewhere on your website where I read that a guy, a polygrapher, had trained his 12-year-old son to beat the polygraph in 20 minutes.
Yeah, and Dr. Drew Richardson, former polygraph expert.
Oh, really? Well, we'll talk all about him when we get right back from this break. It's the Weekend Interview Show.
Okie doke.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with George W. Motschke from antipolygraph.org. And I want to read to y'all this little quote out of the book Technopoly, The Surrender of Culture to Technology by Neil Postman, which I read quite a few years back, and basically makes the argument that American culture at this point is completely surrendered to anything that will be created and will be implemented. Any sort of gadget or technology or new way of doing things will override the old no matter what. And I think we can all think of like the cameras on the roads everywhere as a perfect example. Nobody ever got to vote on the cameras all over the roads, but what happened was the cameras were cheap enough that the state could put them up all over the roads. And so what do we have? Cameras all over the roads. And our culture, which previously would have rejected such things, just completely rolls over to it. And here's what Neil Postman says. He says, Technopoly eliminates alternatives to itself in precisely the way Aldous Huxley outlined in Brave New World. It does not make them illegal. It does not make them immoral. It does not even make them unpopular. It makes them invisible and therefore irrelevant. And it does so by redefining what we mean by religion, by art, by family, by politics, by history, by truth, by privacy, by intelligence, so that our definitions fit its new requirements. And that's basically his book, Technopoly, in a nutshell, is that we will literally redefine what it means to be intelligent based on the newfangled test that supposedly measures intelligence. We will define truth based on the squiggles on a piece of paper, when really in our hearts we all know that you can't measure quality and human feeling with mathematics. Quantity and quality are different things, and one cannot always be used to measure the other. And I think that Neil Postman is probably really onto something there when saying that basically what we've done is we've made technology our God, where we put faith in the gadgets. And you can just think of how many times you hear people say to you, I'm sorry, sir, but the computer says, the computer says you have to go here, the computer says you have to go there, the computer says you didn't pay your bill on time, even though you swear you did. The computer says, and we pass off all our responsibility onto this little electronic doodad, basically. And as we were talking about before, there's no such thing as a lie detector. There's such thing as a sweat and heart rate and pulse and breathing detector that someone might be able to interpret this way or that, and they claim 90% accuracy. But what we're doing is not really measuring lies at all. And as you brought up right before the break, your friend Drew Richardson, the guy from the FBI crime lab taught his 12-year-old son how to beat a polygraph in 20 minutes.
Indeed. You know, I have no objection to reliance on technology if it really works and does, you know, can be proven through the scientific method. But that's simply not the case with the lie detector. It's a myth that has been promoted in large part by the media in the early times, but also by the government. And yet there's, you know, it's often said that lie detectors are controversial, but amongst scientists, there's no controversy at all to speak of. There's near universal agreement that polygraph testing has no scientific basis. It's quackery. And
if the agreement is that deep, if the scientific community agrees almost unanimously, as you say, how can it be that we still have this? I found on your website where the Senate Select Committee on whether polygraphs are any good recommended back in 1976 that all the use of all polygraph machines should be banned from government. How is it that this pseudo-scientific malarkey continues?
Well, agencies of the executive branch of government are very heavily invested in the polygraph. And I think there's a lot of bureaucratic inertia, and there would be a lot of embarrassment and potentially liability if the government were to reverse its reliance on the polygraph. Another factor is that although polygraphs are widely understood not to have any scientific basis, so long as there's a widespread public belief that the polygraph can actually detect lies, it's useful as an interrogation device. That is, people who can be tricked into thinking that the polygraph is detecting a lie may confess to crimes that they otherwise wouldn't, or make admissions that they might not be so willing to make without the threat of a lie detector hanging over their heads. So that usefulness is another thing that has kept the government relying on polygraphs despite the overwhelming scientific evidence against it.
Well, and you know, like in your case where we're talking about counterintelligence and do you or do you not, or have you ever worked as an agent of a foreign power, I mean, these are very important questions, and you know, I can see how, you know, the head of counterterrorism or counterintelligence at the FBI would say, you know, maybe it's not perfect, but we can't take chances with having a bunch of foreign spies. So we have to put everybody through this ringer, you know, even if it is lacking. What would you say to that?
Well, I'd say that makes for very bad policy, because what you end up doing is disqualifying a lot of very qualified people who are telling the truth. And spies are still likely to pass the polygraph because they're the ones who are going to go research the polygraph beforehand.
Right, and now they're safe. And now they're safe.
They've got the polygraph seal of approval.
All right, we'll be right back. Them.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with George W. Motschke from antipolygraph.org. And I have to tell you, George, when I think polygraph, I think of one of the greatest news headlines I've seen in a few years, at least, which was FBI to break out polygraphs in Chalabee probe. And I thought, oh, great, somebody nail Douglas Fife to a chair and hook him up to that damn lie detector machine and grill him. I want to know what Doug Fife knows about the Niger forgeries, and I want to know what Doug Fife knows about Chalabee being a spy for Iran, and I want to know what Doug Fife knows about a whole lot of things. And I really like the idea of him being grilled under hot lights attached to some gadget that's going to freak him out and make him choke and start answering questions truthfully. Am I putting way too much faith in this thing?
I'm afraid the polygraph is not going to provide the answers you seek. No.
The problem is Doug Fife is probably going to pass the test, and then he'll be beyond suspicion from now on, right?
Well, I don't know. It's very uncommon that senior officials are subjected to polygraph examinations to begin with. I think, isn't he a former official now?
Yeah.
I don't think he could be forced to take it in any event. But other people in government can be forced to take the polygraph, like Sybil Edmonds was, under threat of her job. And, you know, it's really something that is more for the lower-ranking people than for the senior officials in government.
Right. And, you know, speaking of the Sybil Edmonds case, it was Malik Can Dickerson, the agent for the American-Turkish Council, that Sybil was complaining about. She passed all of her polygraphs. Oh, no, I've never worked for the American-Turkish Council. I don't know what you're talking about. And they said, oh, okay, fine. Well, then it must be Sybil Edmonds' fault. Let's fire her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know specifically what questions Malik John Dickerson was asked, but if Sybil Edmonds' allegations are true, then it would seem that Dickerson would have necessarily passed the initial pre-employment polygraph while deceptive, and the second one too.
Right. And for the record,
she wouldn't be the first to do that.
Right. For the record, there, real quick, the Inspector General of the Justice Department has confirmed in his unclassified version of the summary of his report to the Senate that everything she said was basically substantiated, and that he didn't find any deception at all. Even though we really don't know at the end of the day, really, what Sybil Edmonds' story is even really about. We do know at least that the people with the security clearance who've investigated her from the Inspector General's office have said that she's telling the truth about that.
Yes, indeed. So other than this case, there's
well, Aldrich Ames, the Soviet spy, right?
Right. He passed twice while spying for the Russians.
In fact, I think I read something that said that after he passed, there was a different agent who was entirely innocent who failed the test, and that the FBI then spent, or the CIA's counterintelligence or whoever it was, then spent a year focused on this innocent man while Aldrich Ames was still giving away the whole house.
Right. In a sense, the polygraph afforded Aldrich Ames protection and misdirected investigative efforts on him and on onto an innocent employee, which has happened before, too. FBI agent Mark Malla failed a routine polygraph screening in 1995, and the FBI launched a huge counterintelligence investigation of him that lasted a year and a half before they came up with nothing. But it ruined his career because of all the rumor and innuendo around it. He, you know, had no future in the FBI. He ended up resigning. And he's described his experience in detail in a statement that's available on antipolygraph.org.
And also available on your website is the PDF of your ebook, The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, co-written with Gino J. Scalabrini. And in that book, actually, you talk about the reaction at CIA to Aldrich Ames when they finally did bust him. Instead of saying, ah, geez, here we were relying on the polygraphs, and what a terrible mistake we made, they turned around and started polygraphing the hell out of everybody, and I believe it said in your book that eventually 300-something people at the CIA were under suspicion of being foreign spies.
Yeah, something on that order. What they decided to do was to make the criteria for passing the polygraph harder, because they, rather than admitting that polygraphs just don't work, they reinterpreted Ames's chart, the FBI did, to say that, well, he actually did show deception. It's just the CIA polygraphers let him talk himself out of it. So they started accusing more people of deception and ended up putting into limbo the careers of many innocent employees. Now, I don't have personal firsthand knowledge of this, but it's been well documented by former CIA employees.
And also you write in your book about Wen-Ho Lee, the guy who did 9 months in solitary confinement on 99 charges of espionage and whatever, who ended up being let go because he pleaded to the charge of accidentally leaving some information on his computer, which
yeah,
I know
gave
is
him
strange.
An offer he couldn't refuse.
Right.
So
clearly an innocent man entirely.
Yeah, and he passed a polygraph initially administered by the Department of Energy, but and you know, three senior polygraph examiners signed off on this, that he passed very strongly. And that surprised Ed Curran, who was the chief of counterintelligence at the Department of Energy at the time, who was also the guy who instituted the polygraph jihad at the CIA, because the polygraph was supposed to be used as the pretext for firing Wen Houli. He was supposed to fail it, but when he passed, everyone was surprised. Well, they send the results to the FBI, and they reinterpret it as being inconclusive, if not deceptive. And then they...
He kind of passed it too well. That's kind of suspicious, the way he didn't lie at all.
Perhaps. I don't know. They haven't provided any good explanation of how they came to this conclusion. And in any event, the FBI then polygraphed him under circumstances that, according to a book I read, it sounds suspiciously to me as if the FBI polygraph of Wen Houli may have been rigged, because it was conducted in an overheated room with one of the polygraph attachments made so tight that it caused pain. And it's hard to think of an innocent explanation for that kind of conduct.
Right. Basically, they figured if they could just bully him enough before they hook him up to the machine, that his heart will be racing enough that they can get that negative result that they're looking for. Basically,
yeah, it's a fishing expedition. Examinations can be easily rigged by an unscrupulous examiner.
Yeah, or even as I'm finding as I'm reading through the examples on your website, a lot of times it almost seems like somebody sits down with the polygrapher who they end up just kind of have a personal problem, and they just don't get along on a personal level, and the next thing you know, they're drummed out of their job. And it's, you know, I think one of them was the guy said, they asked if I'd ever inhaled pot smoke, and he said, well, yeah, you know, I've been to concerts before. And, oh, yeah, well, you're some hippie. And then they just go after this guy and manipulate him in every way they can into coming up with some kind of false negative result, when really it's just a matter of, for whatever reason, when they met the polygrapher, they just didn't really get along very well.
Well, yeah, a polygrapher's bias can certainly affect the outcome. In fact, one former FBI polygraph operator, opined the FBI has drug usage guidance for applicants. They can have smoked marijuana up to 15 times. If you've done it more times than that, you're not eligible to work as an FBI special agent. Well, in an email message, this former FBI polygrapher named Byford said that, well, come on, if a person has smoked marijuana 15 times, he's done it, I don't know, 50 or more. So he assumes that anyone who's, you know, done it a number of times close to the limit must have done it more than that. And says that if things were his way, no one who has ever smoked marijuana would ever work for the FBI. So when you have someone with that kind of bias, it can certainly influence the outcome of the polygraph. That is the examiner's expectations and personal biases can affect outcomes.
Now, somewhere you wrote that the polygraph machine basically is as bad as tarot cards, that we might as well just consult the stars to ask whether this guy's lying or not. We basically have just as good of a chance. Is it really that bad?
Well, it's close. It does, again, have certain utility in interrogations with people who don't know that it's all a sham. Because if the person thinks that the device can detect lies, well, maybe you'll get a confession or admission that otherwise would be hard to get. So it does have some usefulness in that regard. But, yeah, as for examinations of the polygraph charts and trying to divine truth from them, might as well consult astrological charts.
What does it take to become a polygraph expert?
Well, the longest polygraph school is the Department of Defense Polygraph Institute, and it takes just a 14-week course, which is shorter than much shorter than the typical barber college.
Shorter than the barber college, huh?
Indeed.
And about the same length as clown college.
Although I think clowns and barbers provide a more valuable public service.
Oh, man. So is there a better way? Should we look to higher tech in terms of brain scans and that kind of thing? I'm sure there's a scientist somewhere who could say, aha, he's lying because that part of his brain lit up. What about that?
Well, that remains experimental, and certainly there's nothing ready now that they can. There's no known way to detect an actual lie. There are brain tests that can detect apparently with a high degree of accuracy whether a person recognizes or has familiarity with some stimulus, but it's different from telling if a person is lying or not.
Right. And so it's really the same thing again. It's really sort of, well, here's an indicator that may or may not mean whatever I think it does.
Well, yeah. There's actually a technique that can be done either with a polygraph or with these examining a reaction called the P300 in the brain, called a guilty knowledge test, also a concealed information test. And it's different from a lie test. That the point is just to see if a person has knowledge about a certain crime or event. To give you a quick example, suppose in the New York City subway threat, people who are suspected of being involved with that supposed plot could have been asked, well, connected to a polygraph, a series of questions. If you were involved with the plot, you would know what city the target is. Is it New York? Is it Washington? Is it Los Angeles? Is it Seattle? And so forth. And if the person reacts most strongly to New York, the city that it's to be, might assume that, well, maybe they know something about the plot. Then you ask another series, if you're involved in the plot, you would know what type of facility is to be attacked. Is it the Statue of Liberty? Is it the Empire State Building, the subway system, Coney Island? And if they react most strongly to the subway, you would might again infer that, well, perhaps they know something about it. But this is different from the typical lie detector test where questions would be asked such as, are you involved with that bomb plot, yes or no? And the attempt to define whether or not you're lying.
What about voice stress analyzers? I actually saw an advertisement for, I can't remember how much it cost, but it was pretty expensive, and it said, you know, you can even, I think, hook this up to your telephone, and so when you're doing business with people over the phone, it'll alert you if they're being dishonest with you.
Total quackery. There's no scientific support for those at all. But the only people claiming that they work are the manufacturers and salesmen of these devices.
Oh, they're the only ones.
The only ones.
Okay, well now, okay, if the FBI was here to defend themselves, wouldn't they say that at least in terms of their polygraph machines that they like go through and test their guys and make sure that they have some high rate of accuracy or something like that? Is there not a way to at least judge, if it's not a science but an art, is there a way at least to kind of scientifically judge who's really good at divining these answers and maybe who isn't?
Well, my understanding is that the way that polygraph examiners are typically rated is on the basis of the confessions or admissions that they obtain.
Oh, good. So sort of like a conviction rate.
Yeah, the thing that listeners need to understand is that polygraph testing is actually all about interrogation, getting information from people. The polygraph is a sort of a prop. Many polygraphers actually believe that it can detect deception, but its main utility is as an interrogational tool.
Right. They say, you know, you take a criminal, you just hook them up to the copy machine and tell them, hey, this thing's going to tell us if you're lying, and the criminal doesn't know the difference, right? That's basically the purpose.
That urban legend apparently has a basis in fact.
Yeah. There was a post up on your website by a guy who calls himself Railroaded, who said that he was accused of some sort of sexual impropriety with his kids, right? Oh, I'm sitting here looking at the wrong part of my notes here. Right, and he refused to take the polygraph, and he said, the guy says, you know, his life was ruined, he had to move out of town, and he never even got to find out who his accuser was after all this happened. So I wonder, in those circumstances, if this guy is truly innocent, should he not have just gone in there and taken his chances with the polygraph? Because instead, what he did was cast a bunch of suspicion on himself by refusing to take it, didn't he?
No. If you're asked to take a polygraph in such a circumstance, you're already under suspicion. And anyone accused of a crime would be wise to refuse the polygraph and get a lawyer. As used by the police, the polygraph test is generally little more than a pretext for interrogating someone without a lawyer present. The polygraphers will say that only the examinee and the examiner can be in the room together, no lawyers allowed.
Oh, so this isn't an interrogation. I'm just polygraphing you.
Yeah, well, it's presented under the false pretext of being a test for truth, but the person isn't told that when the test shows deception, he's going to be subjected to a harsh interrogation.
All right, now we all know that these things aren't admissible in criminal court. How long ago was it that they were banned from criminal court? How long were they in, or how long were they allowed, really, before that? I'll save your answer till we get right back from this break. I'm talking with George W. Motschke from antipolygraph.org. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with George W. Motschke from antipolygraph.org. He's the author of the book, The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, that he co-wrote with Gino J. Scalabrini. And I was just bringing up the question right before the break there. I guess I've known since I was a little kid that polygraph results are not admissible in a criminal case. And it made me curious about maybe when the Supreme Court ruled that and how long they had been admissible before they were finally disallowed?
Well, the major precedent on polygraph admissibility was actually a D.C. Court of Appeals decision in the case of Frye versus United States back in 1923.
Oh, really? Way back then?
Way back then. So,
how long had they been admissible before that, do you know?
Well, I don't know, and of course that court's decision didn't bind all the courts of the United States, although it was largely followed. Even today, under some circumstances, if, for example, in some states, if the prosecution and the defense stipulate that the polygraph results will be admissible, it may be admitted as evidence in a court of law. And there is a infamous case in Ohio Floyd Fay, who made such an agreement for a stipulation that the results would be admissible, and this is in the 1980s. He went to jail after failing a polygraph regarding a murder he was suspected of but didn't commit. He was later proved innocent and released from prison.
So when he agreed that it would be admissible, that was before he took it, or they lied and told him that he passed it, but really had it, or what?
Typically, it's done beforehand. Here's the deal that's given to the person. Look, if you want to be cleared of suspicion in this crime, submit to a polygraph, and under the stipulation that the results will be admissible in court, the prosecution has nothing to lose if the person passes, because usually it's a case that would be, you know, that they wouldn't be able to, don't think they could prove without the polygraph results or a confession.
So kind of a whole new prisoner's dilemma there, right?
Yeah, so and the prisoner's thinking, well, or suspect, I should say, is thinking, well, maybe I can, you know, clear my name by taking the polygraph. And sometimes they'll naively agree to such terms.
What do you think about the technique of using or like watching facial expressions, which way people's eyes move, or frowns. They call them micro expressions, I guess. Little lines in the forehead. I'm thinking of Dick Cheney on Meet the Press. Any given clip of Dick Cheney, there's always something very weird going on with his mouth and his eyeballs as he's telling lies. Is that really any better than polygraphing? Still just a matter of impression, right?
I have to say, I don't know. I feel that I haven't, I'm not very well informed about.
I saw something on the Learning Channel or something a few years ago where they said that the Secret Service's technique is they look for tiny little lines in your forehead, and that they do better than that. Nobody else, all these self-appointed experts online, the only people who test any better than chance were the Secret Service, and that was the technique they used, was little bitty lie lines in the forehead. All right, well, thank you very much for your time today, everybody. Check out antipolygraph.org and the book The Lie Behind the Lie Detector, written by George W. Motschke and Gino J. Scalabrini. Thanks very much for your time today, sir. Appreciate it. All right, have a good one. And everybody, we'll be right back with Loretta Napoleone.